Howdy, regulars. This is Regular Dispatch 71. It's August 6th, 2020. Every August, at the Little League World Series in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, a team of 11 and 12-year-old boys from Curaçao stages a vivid reenactment of David versus Goliath. Actually, it's more like David versus 15 Goliaths. In a 16-team tournament frequently dominated by hulking, flame-throwing man-boys, this wiry, undersized team of nobodies from a tiny, remote Caribbean island somehow keeps succeeding. In a worldwide competition where qualifying two consecutive years is considered a remarkable achievement, the Curaçao boys have made it to the semifinals six times in the last 8 years, winning the title in 2004 and finishing second in 2005. As ESPN announcers have christened it, Curaçao is the little island that could. Curaçao's accomplishments are even more impressive for the fact that compared with the teams they beat, they have precious few facilities. There are only two Little League regulation fields on the entire island, and one batting cage constructed of tattered fishnet. What's more, the Curaçao baseball season lasts but 5 months. Practices are held three times a week, and games are on weekends, a schedule that contrasts markedly with the year-round approach of other places like Venezuela. When I saw them in Williamsport at the 2007 series, the younger members of the Curaçao team were bemused by the spectacle of the Japanese team doing drills before breakfast. "Why do they do that?" one player asked me, mystified. The most compelling element of this underdog story, however, is that Curaçao's success can be traced to a single moment of ignition. Actually, two moments, lasting approximately 3 seconds each. They both happened at Yankee Stadium on October 20th, 1996, in the opening game of the World Series between the Atlanta Braves and the New York Yankees. Like many moments of ignition, this one fascinates because it hangs so heavily on chance, literally on the postage stamp size area of contact created when a round bat meets a round ball. 1/8 of an inch either way, and if history is any guide, the Curaçao phenomenon would not have happened. The situation at Yankee Stadium seemed unpromising. No score, top of the second inning. Braves runner on first base. An unknown 19-year-old Curaçao rookie named Andrew Jones stood at the plate, wiggling his bat, a Mona Lisa smile creasing his chubby face. Jones had started his season at the single-A level of the minor leagues. He'd been promoted to the majors only 2 months earlier. The Yankee ace, Andy Pettit, stared him down with the somber expression of a bullfighter. Pettit was only a few years older, but in this image, the narrative was clear. Canny veteran versus naive rookie. Pettit worked the count full, then unleashed his best pitch, a nasty slider. The intention was to induce the rookie to do what most rookies do in that situation, get fooled, reach for the pitch, and ground into a double play. But Jones was not most rookies. Jones recognized the spin on the slider and slammed the pitch 10 rows into the left field seats. 56,000 Yankee fans went quiet as Jones, his smile broadening, sped around the bases. It was an extraordinary feat, one that couldn't possibly be outdone, but then it was. The very next inning, Jones walked up to the plate and, on another full count pitch, smashed an even more towering drive into the left field seats. The television announcers gasped and stammered as if solving a difficult mathematical equation. World Series plus Yankee Stadium plus unknown teenager equals two consecutive home runs? A nuclear burst of media attention followed, hailing Jones as natural-born talent, comparing him to Clemente, Mantle, and Da Vinci, marveling at his unearthly, God-given quickness of his wrists. In fact, that quickness was no gift from above. Jones had been swinging a bat since the age of two, coached by his father, Henry. When he was older, Andrew swung a sledgehammer three times a week, rolling his wrists in a circle to build hand speed and strength. As Jones later put it, "My dad taught me baseball stuff to work my ass off." The Hall of Fame in Cooperstown requested Jones's bat, and it was called the greatest debut in World Series history. Like a shockwave, Jones' historic feat flashed on screens across the world. But all that was nothing compared to the blast that rocked Jones' hometown of Willemstad, Curacao's Little League founder, Frank Curiel, remembers the sound he heard when Jones hit the home runs. It was very, very loud. Firecrackers, yelling, everyone shouting, everyone waking up. A few weeks later at Little League, signups for the first aftershock showed up in the form of 400 new kids. Their motivation was perhaps all the stronger since they knew that Jones hadn't even been one of the best players on the island. As a 15-year-old, he had switched from third base to outfield so he could get more playing time. After all, if he could do it. Even with the extraordinary infusion of enthusiastic recruits, Curacao's talent bloom took time to develop, just as it did for Russia's tennis players and South Korea's golfers. Not until 2001, 5 years after Jones' home run, did a team of Curacao Little Leaguers arrive at Howard J. Lamod Stadium in Williamsport to compete in the Little League World Series. Tournament officials considered it a fluke appearance. After all, Curacao had qualified for the Little League World Series only once before, back in 1980. And as Little League World Series press officer Christopher Downs put it, Curacao had always been pretty miserable. But the Curacao team, half of which had originally signed up after Jones's homers, surprised observers by reaching the international final. Though they lost 2-1 to the eventual champions from Tokyo, they had succeeded at establishing the Giant Slayer plotline that they faithfully followed ever since. As is true of any talent hotbed, Curacao's success wasn't caused solely by the primal signals that created ignition. The matrix of other causes includes disciplined culture, top-notch coaching, supportive parents, national pride, the love of the game, and of course, a wealth of deep practice. From what I saw, Jones's style of training is the rule, not the exception. Part of the answer is that Curacao, like other talent hotbeds, has found a way to do a very important and tricky thing, to keep the motivational fire lit. It's one thing to persuade Scrooge to crack open his vault. It's another to persuade him to splurge on Christmas geese day after day, year after year. Curacao forms, quite by accident, a natural case study on the science and practice of sustained ignition. Ignition in Curacao or anywhere doesn't come with guarantees. For every breakthrough performance that ignites a talent bloom, there are dozens of breakthroughs that peter out. Germany's Boris Becker won Wimbledon at 17, but inspired no tectonic wave of players. Miguel Cervantes dazzled the Shakespearean era with Don Quixote, but had little apparent effect in his native Spain. The painter Edvard Munch of the Scream remains the sole member of that oxymoronic group, Norwegian Expressionists. These cases and others like them lead us to an interesting question. Why do breakthrough performances sometimes ignite talent blooms and sometimes not? The answer is that talent hotbeds possess more than a single primal cue. They contain complex collections of signals, people, images, and ideas that keep ignition going for the weeks, months, and years that skill growing requires. Talent hotbeds are to primal cues what Las Vegas is to neon signs, flashing with the kind of signals that keep motivation burning. Consider the sights that a young Michelangelo would have encountered in a single afternoon in Florence. In a half-hour stroll, he could have visited the workshops of dozens of great artists. These were not quiet studios. To the contrary, they were beehives, overseen by a master and hustling team of journeymen and apprentices, competing for commissions, filling orders, making plans, testing new techniques. He could have encountered Donatello's St. Mark statue, Ghiberti's Gates of Paradise, the works of painters from his boss, Ghirlandaio, through Masaccio, Giotto, and Cimabue. I could be getting all of these names. I could be pronouncing them all wrong. We'll see. The greatest hits of architecture, painting, and sculpture, all of them were concentrated within a few blocks. All of them were simply part of the landscape of everyday life, and all flash signals that added up to one energizing message: better get busy. Or consider the scene at the Mermaid Tavern in London during Shakespeare's day. There across the river from the Globe Theatre, the major writers of the day, Marlowe, Jonson, Donne, Raleigh, gathered to talk shop and match wits. Or consider the Academy and Lyceum of Athens, where Plato, Aristotle, and the rest taught, argued, and learned. Or consider the thronging environs of Sao Paulo, While walking around one afternoon, I attempted to keep track of the number of signals about soccer I spotted. A TV highlight, a billboard, an overheard conversation, 4 futsal pickup games, 5 kids juggling balls down the street. I lost track somewhere after 50. And I'm going to skip a bunch of pages here and just read the last paragraph of this section. The larger reason, however, is that Curaçao possessed a set of tools to keep the ignition of Jones's success lit. Curaçao grew talent because the message of Jones' success was translated and amplified into a reliable combination of primal cues. Frank Curiel-Field, after all, only looks like a beat-up baseball diamond. It is, in fact, a million-watt antenna steadily transmitting a powerful stream of signals and images that add up to a thrilling whisper. Hey, that could be you. So this is somewhere in the middle of the talent code, back to Daniel Coyne's book. It's fantastic. And of course, this one really delves into a place, the sense of place, and a particular place's effect on the individuals in it, and calling, kind of summoning this greatness, this skill development. I'm sitting here in Austin on a Thursday and thinking about it. You know, Willie Nelson might be a similar figure in our trajectory, certainly in the legends and lore of Austin. Looking at the poster I have of Willie Nelson's first show at the Armadillo from August 12th, I think in 72, and a famous event here. And of course, out of that, out of the Armadillo, out of Willie, grows Austin City Limits, one of the greatest sort of ways of sharing, exporting Austin-ness with the world. And it serves as a clarion call for musicians everywhere to come here for their own creative freedom and fun. Even without COVID, Austin's going through quite a change. I didn't grow up here myself. I grew up in Dallas-Fort Worth. My mom grew up here. My mom's from here. I would come down here quite a bit as a kiddo, but I didn't live here. So I count as one of the transplants getting here in the mid-90s. And there's just been cranes everywhere the whole time I've been here. And that's not necessarily a bad thing at all. But the cost of living is rising. And so the idea that you can just come here and have fun and create and not have to worry about making the rent is pretty far in the distance, really. And there's definitely a drumbeat now of musicians that have no choice but to leave, and artists of all kinds, really, and communities of all kinds, really, being affected by it. It's a fascinating phenomenon. It happens basically everywhere. The artists move in, they find cheap space where they can do their thing. If the place catches fire, it attracts more people. And it seems to be difficult, doesn't it, to have enough space to satisfy, like with supply and demand, then you should just build more space and it satisfies the demand and prices stay low. Here in Austin, there are breaks on the development of real estate of various kinds. The environmental community is one, but also the older neighborhoods are another. Austin heavily restricts like garage apartments and multifamily, not even like massive apartment complexes, but in old neighborhoods, duplexes, quadplexes, these kinds of things. And when you do that, then you restrict the supply, and demand is ever increasing as the population grows. Well, it's clear what happens. Rents go up. This weekend, there's an event happening here that's sort of melancholy, sad, tragic about Austin. It's all right for Eddie and Sandra. I think in the long run, they'll be, you know, they had a good run. But Threadgills is holding an auction this weekend. The final Threadgills standing, the original Threadgills that stood built in 33 at the time on the outskirts, the northern edge, past the northern edge of town, on what was then the old Dallas Highway, now known as Lamar Boulevard. And I heard the story. I was down at the Riverside Threadgills when it closed sometime last year. But that whole weekend, I just kind of hung out there and heard Eddie talking with the broker who brokered both sides of the deal between Eddie and Kenneth Threadgill himself. And Threadgill related that he picked that spot because he got on the old Dallas Highway and drove out of town to the last light. He didn't want to have to spend any extra money on extending electricity to his property. So he found a piece of dirt on the old Dallas Highway under the last streetlight. And that became Threadgill's, a filling station, a gas station. And famously, he got the first liquor license after Prohibition in Travis County. At least that's the lore of the tale. And he ran that for a long, long time. He was a yodeler, musician himself. Apparently, lots of UT kids would hang out there. Janis Joplin played there when she got to town. Eddie had run the Armadillo and the Raw Deal, a little bar on 6th and Sabine downtown, right by 35, in between 35 and Red River. And he took over the Armadillo, built the downtown location just south across the river, very near where the Armadillo once stood. Lost that last year because his monthly expenditure just went through the roof, something like $7,000 a month to $38,000 a month when a 25-year lease lapsed, something like that. I mean, that's how much aggressive inflation in land value there has been down there. And retreated to the North Lamar location, and COVID and other factors have forced them to close. Eddie is an incredible collector and archivist. Personally owns like UT annuals, yearbooks from going all the way back, has phone books in Austin going all the way back, publications that predate the Chronicle, like The Sun and The Rag. He has physical copies of all of it. Tons of posters, music memorabilia. And Eddie was just kind of known around town for decades. If an establishment closed, failed, he was told about it. And often he would go by with a truck or a trailer and get his hands on the old Nighthawk neon signs and just all manner of stuff. And all that will be auctioned off this weekend. It will, you know, hopefully all land in good hands, and that's cool. But that piece of dirt that stood since 33 as Threadgill's will vanish. It will become a loft indistinguishable from anything else, the same as any number of other blocks in town and any number of other towns. And it's going to be interesting to see what's left standing after COVID. And of course, there's already plenty of trends and force and challenge facing all kinds of businesses. Anyway, it's not all dire. It's not all downbeat, because you do have something like the Alamo Draft House that could come along up here through Austin and reimagine and reinvent movie going and take charge. I've spent quite a bit of time talking about Gary Shandling recently, and Gary Shandling looking at the boundaries of and the form of a sitcom, a talk show, DVD commentaries. I think if we have to credit Carrie and Tim League with the same, of really just taking the reins and seeing the boundaries, the structure, the experience, the pathways that is going to the movies, but just refusing to accept the status quo and applying their creativity to all of it. And I hope they survive this too. I don't know how they're doing it right now when nobody goes to the movies. They're trying to get back, I think. But they represent something that's still very quintessentially Austin, signature Austin, exporting that idea, growing. So that's really good. And there are even in the world of restaurants, there are lots of local restaurant groups, Torchy's, Taco Deli, Hop Dottie, there's P. Terry's, there's a bunch that are in Franklin's and the whole barbecue world and all of that. It's all great. And I'm sure there's still plenty of, obviously there's still plenty of live music venues, and hopefully always will be in Austin. But it's just a challenging period. And in particular, though, it's a sad, sad, sad moment for Threadgills to go away. To lose that, for that bit of dirt to become something else is real, really, really, really tough. Reading this piece, though, it also has me thinking about Austin. I don't think a lot of places actually really right now. I think Austin could be more intentional, could be more deliberate about what it's trying to foster. And I'm not talking about like economic development people, the chamber, the city, the mayor, just us, to really team up. I think we could use, I'm going to spend some time thinking about it, I guess, over the next week or so. Like, we need more Willy moments of that kind of, in the words of the talent code here, in Coyle's words, ignition. This moment of ignition, this whisper, twofold really, one a possibility and one a real provocation. It's like, hey, this could be you, and also better get busy. Better get busy, because it's none of these things are given tomorrow, and that magical mix of primal cues can start to erode and wither. And it seems to me, in the way it's described in this book, there is no one sufficient condition, and there are many necessary conditions. And so the loss of any single one can be punishing to the vitality of a place. People definitely continue to stream into Texas, stream into Austin. And so it strikes me that we should do a better job with a welcoming committee and making sure that we are shining a light where all the magic in the town are, of people that are really capable of firing up others, not just in music, not just in food, not just in tech, but across the board. It's a great place. It could be a whole lot more, and hopefully it will be. It's fun to contemplate. Hope y'all are doing great, and I'll talk to you tomorrow. Thanks.